On this week's Big Tech Show, how will the latest developments in artificial intelligence affect your life? Will you get new powerful personal assistants? Are you in danger of something terrible happening? We explain what's going on.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Anthropic, which is OpenAI competitor, their startup lab, actually founded by former OpenAI employees, they actually eclipsed GPT-4 only just a couple of weeks ago with their latest model, and the internet went crazy. This is just better than GPT-4 at everything. So OpenAI had to respond to that.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
Seachtain, an Indo-Ascaliger.
Time I mon iarracht I aon of chacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam a machan seo, gur féidir é a chur in uig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltí, fís, tuirmí.
Tá sé dochreitse nach bhéadach ara I gúrna meán an cheistin a eicol.
Bhí an tálam a gináam gribh orachar an reachtam, Iadach sé tarin gribhan orachar san I lis dúhal agus gimine fnacht gór a clig sár ducha sin eachar. Now ni vin aon dar darach sin, vin marav.
Seachtain, find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
He cajoled his mother-in-law, Rose Callady, to go on to the Late Late to appeal for witnesses. And there's a very famous scene, and in fact, it's used quite a lot by criminal psychologists when you want to analyse. At this stage, the Gardaí suspected him. They didn't like what they were saying. So they had people, professionals, watching the Late Late Show, and obviously it was recorded. And clearly from the body language of Rose Callady that night, she sat there rigid, some people would say with rage. And, you know, you could see that she was very, very uncomfortable.
Murder happened was in the bedroom, which is the very last room of the house. So it's the room where you're least likely to bring someone you don't know because you're cornered. My view as well would be, and again, it's just my view, it's not a police theory, it's just my own personal belief, is that she knew the person because why else would you kill her?
He gave a flippant interview and he seemed to be almost enjoying the attention, which again is another classic sign of the psychopath.
We met years ago, about 13 years ago, at softball, which is a game like baseball, where Rachel took it up. She was a lot better than I was.
When you look back on it, you say, Jesus Christ, this guy is saying, hey, folks, I'm guilty, but you're not going to catch me, catch me, catch me.
Today on the Indo Daily, Joe O'Reilly's murder of his wife Rachel became one of the most notorious cases in the country. Staged as a burglary, O'Reilly thought he had carried out the perfect murder. But phone calls he made throughout that day would lead to his alibi unravelling. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Paul Williams, special correspondent with the Irish Independent, to take us through the story and the lengths Joe O'Reilly went through to cover up his crime. Paul, tell us about Rachel O'Reilly, or Rachel Callaly, as her family likes her to be called now.
Well, imperfectly correctly too, because why should the victim of this horrific murder carry the name of the person who plotted and murdered her? What we know of Rachel Callaly is that she was adopted by Rose and Jim Callaly. She was big into sport. She had a big circle of friends. She grew up on the north side of Dublin. She was a perfectly normal, healthy, wonderful human being. And her life story takes a major turn when she meets this guy called Joe O'Reilly, who she'd worked with, I believe, in Arnott's department store at one stage. And they met in the early 90s. He was 20, she was 18. And they fell in love and they married. And that's where this whole horrific tragedy starts.
Yeah, so they're originally living on the north side, and then ultimately they have two sons and they move out to North County Dublin. And she's raising the boys and she's cut back on her own career while Joe works away. Where do things start to go awry?
Well, their early lives have been described, you know, their early married life has been quite happy. They had the two kids, they bought a bungalow in Donal in North County Dublin in around 2002. A few years, just 2 years before her murder. But somewhere along the line, it started to go wrong. And that it started to go wrong when O'Reilly had an affair with a woman he'd worked with called Nikki Pelly. And he fell in love with her and he decided he no longer loved his wife, Rachel. And it's probably one of the oldest stories in humankind. You know, one of the partners in a relationship meets somebody else, they fall in love with that person, they fall out of love with the person they're with. And the thing called divorce happens and they separate. separate or whatever, and a lot of heartache. But this was one of these, you know, small number of cases, and this is why I suppose it's so fascinating for the public. The love turned to hate, but not just hate, but hate on a level, murderous hate, whereby it brought out the psychopath in Joe O'Reilly, that Joe O'Reilly decided that he was not going to have the life he wanted. It was all about himself with Nikki Pelley and his two kids until he got rid of Rachel. And that's why he set about murdering his wife, and why this became one of the most high profile murders in the past 20, 30 years in this country.
Yeah, so in his mind, he views Rachel as an obstacle to this new life for him. He doesn't want to be a divorced dad, seeing the kids at weekends, so he doesn't view divorce as the option. We proceed then to that fateful day, October 4th, 2004. Mm. Starts out as a normal day, though, really, doesn't it?
Well, let's just briefly go through what he did that day. It's the Monday, October the 4th, 2004. He was up at 5 a.m. He left the house. He went towards the Jackie Skelly gym in Park West on the outskirts of southwest Dublin, and he was due to meet a friend and workmate there at 6:30 and do a bit of training with him. He stopped for petrol after his session in the gym. Himself and his mate left separately from the gym and went to their office, which was Viacom Outdoor Advertising, which was in the Bluebell Industrial Estate near Ballyfermot. He sent an email to a colleague and warning him that he might be out of phone coverage for most of the morning and that they could meet for lunch later that day. It would appear that at this stage, this is when he set about his plan to murder his wife.
What do we know of from there?
Well, we know that evidence given from telephone records at the time showed that at 8:12 a.m. he got a call from Nikki Pelley, his lover, and it was routed through a telephone mast at Chapel Isa, just north of the industrial estate where he worked. So that showed where he was in that particular area at the time. But then CCTV evidence then showed O'Reilly's car was seen at a number of locations, including Blake's Cross, which was close to the M1 in North County Dublin, and then passing an area called Murphy's Quarry in the direction of the O'Reilly home. And that was at 9:10 a.m. 15 minutes later, and an incoming call to O'Reilly's mobile went through the mast at Murphy's Quarry near the family home. So this is where, for the first time, by the way, the significance of this is where telecommunications evidence was really used so effectively for the first time.
So what we're seeing here is that far from going to the Broadstone bus garage, he's actually gone up towards his own home. What happens from there?
And he thinks he's off the radar. So on that morning, Rachel had left her home shortly before 9 a.m. and her car was picked up on CCTV cameras at 9:03 a.m. passing the same quarry, Murphy's Quarry. She was on her way to drop her son Luke to school before leaving the other son Adam to his creche. Now, 9:41, police cameras spotted her car passing the quarry en route back to the house. So she arrived home at around 9:45. O'Reilly was waiting for her in her bedroom. This is where the staged burglary takes place. And as she walked through the door, he struck her on the head with a blunt instrument, which was always believed to be a dumbbell, a weight that he was using in a home gym. And he rained blows down on her and until she was dead. It was a horrific scene, apparently, by all accounts, from what we were told at the time. And in order to make it look like a burglary, then he ransacked the room, pulled out drawers and stole a camera. And he got rid of the weapon too. And he later suggested to a friend of Rachel's that it must have been disposed of in, quotes, water to get rid of the DNA, which was one of the strange sort of things that happened, which led to his downfall. Mm. But in his haste then to get back to the city, to where he said he was all the time, he made a number of mistakes. He forgot, for example, to take money from his wife's purse, a decision that immediately made Rachel's mother and the Gardaí think the burglary had been staged.
From this point then, he has murdered his wife. He is attempting to return to a normal schedule. From there, he manipulates it such that her mother discovers the body and he pretends as if everything is normal that morning.
And this is where this whole crime illustrates how hideous it was and also what a psychotic creature he was, that he didn't read, like he was a classic psychopath, and this, his need to get out of his life with his wife basically brought all these qualities out in him. That morning, between 11:52 and 1:45 p.m., he left four voicemails on Rachel's mobile phone. And during that time, he got a call from the creche saying that his son hadn't been picked up. And he decided, well, OK, I better go and collect my son. Again, as you say, everything is normal. It's all perfectly normal. But then he called Rachel's mum. So basically, she went to the house to find her daughter bludgeoned to death. And he set that up. He wanted her, Rachel Callady's mother has always said that consistently, that she believed that Joe O'Reilly wanted her to find her daughter that morning.
He is pretending, basically, from the time at which he has murdered Rachel, that everything is normal. This is his creation of an alibi, that he has continued on with work. He's left phone calls for her. He didn't get the phone call from the creche. He naturally goes to pick up his son. He naturally rings his mother-in-law to check in on his wife, knowing all the time that this has happened. He then arrives out at the house, and again, there's an act put on here where he claims that
he was actually so upset. In his bid to make himself look beyond suspicion, apparently he was even prepared to bring his child, the little child, into the house innocently, like you would do because you don't know what's going on in the house. And a neighbour stopped him, and then he ran by his mother-in-law straight to the house, into the bedroom, and he called, "Jesus, Rachel, what did you do?" And that's where it starts.
That night, by the way, he stays at his mother's house, gets the clothes that he's wearing cleaned. So again, he's covering his tracks. The murder weapon has been disposed of and is never found. But ultimately, what raises suspicions is his rather strange behaviour. Can you go through a couple of those incidents?
You are right. It looked for a short while for him that his plan was going well because it was a burglary gone wrong. But on October the 12th, Gardaí gave him back the keys of the family home after it had been obviously a murder scene and a crime scene. And the next day he invited Rachel's parents, Rose and Jim, to come over, saying he felt there was peace in the house and that he felt Rachel was there. And they were a bit wary of him, but agreed to go, but brought along their son and his wife. And he brought them into the bedroom and then did something that sort of appalled the family of this murdered woman. He started to act out the murder in front of them, raising his hand and drawing it down, then going down on his hunkers, all the time administering imaginary blows at the spot where Rachel died. And he pointed out the blood spatter, which was still on the walls and the door frame. And then he moved into the bathroom. And he told the women there that it was likely that they went to clean up in the bathroom, the killer or killers. But they heard her gurgling and went back to finish her off. Like, this is extraordinary stuff to come from a man who's the love of his life, his wife, the mother of his two children, has been so brutally murdered. To come out with detail. It's like, you know, some of these guys, like when you deal with criminal psychology, they say some of these guys have really dangerous minds and can really plot and plan and cold-bloodedly plan something. But this guy was leaving footprints all over the place in the snow that an elephant could track, you know.
He also, inside in work, colleagues say he was acting perfectly normal considering he was supposed to be in mourning. He goes on the Late Show, and again, it's a sign of this erratic, attention-seeking behaviour.
He apparently cajoled his mother-in-law, Rose Callady, to go on to the Late Late to appeal for witnesses. And there's a very famous scene, and in fact, it's used quite a lot by criminal psychologists when you want to analyse, because at this stage, the Gardaí suspected him. They didn't like what they were saying. So they had people, professionals, watching the Late Late Show, and obviously it was recorded. And clearly from the body language of Rose Callady that night, she sat there rigid, some people would say with rage, and you know, you could see that she was very, very uncomfortable.
He rang us that night and invited us down. He said he was going down to the house the next day, and he felt so great after it. He thought it would do us good. But I walked out of the house knowing without a shadow of a doubt in my mind that he had murdered Rachel.
Again, when you look back on it, you say, Jesus Christ, this guy is saying, hey, folks, I'm guilty, but you're not going to catch me. He's, for example, he gave a flippant interview and he seemed to be almost enjoying the attention, which again is another classic sign of the psychopath. Pat Murray, who was the lead detective in this case, like in so many famous Garda, who's now retired, he said he interviewed the staff in RT, and he found that he was acting like a man who wasn't in any way grieving. Like, he scoffed all the sandwiches, ate all the crisps, drank all the tea when he was in the green room. It just wasn't, everything about him was wrong. It was off. The guy wasn't overcome with grief. He was putting on a performance.
Ultimately, this behaviour brings him to the attention of the guards. But what we see ultimately in this prosecution is the use of modern technology. You have obviously advances in DNA in that period, but in this case we see CCTV and mobile phone pinging effectively come to the fore.
Yeah, but this is at a time in criminal history, criminal investigative history, that, you know, we're seeing an evolution and a revolution in investigative techniques, because just shortly towards the end of the 90s, we have the introduction, wholesale introduction of DNA. We have also got increasingly much more sophisticated and reliable CCTV systems. But primarily, we have the increasing use of digital telephone technology, and as that technology is growing in sophistication, it's becoming easier and easier to track phones and trace phones. Now, I remember in Veronica Guerin's murder, which was 1996, that was the very, very first time they used telephone technology. But there was an awful lot of holes in the evidence of that, because it wasn't as traceable as it was in 2004. So this was the very first case, really, certainly the most high-profile case, where telephone technology really did work, because what it did was it literally brought us on the journey that Joe O'Reilly took that morning, where he was receiving calls, what mass were calls were bouncing from, clearly put a lie to his claim that he was somewhere else. It literally gave the police, the Gardaí, a map of his movements that morning, and then his behaviour and all of that came together in a wall of evidence that ultimately convicted him.
So in this case, we've no witnesses, we have no murder weapon, there's no DNA evidence pinning it on him. So he almost concocted the perfect murder, did he? But he's basically caught out by his own hubris.
Absolutely. That's the best way to describe it. And then it's supported technologically. There's a raw elements to this story. Like, on the morning of Rachel Callaly's funeral on October the 11th, it had been suggested that family and friends might like to write letters and cards to Rachel to be placed in her coffin. And Joe sat at the kitchen table and wrote a letter to his wife. And her body was subsequently exhumed in March 2005, which illustrates again how much the Gardaí went into this.
Garda forensic specialists moved into the Fingal burial ground at first light this morning. The cemetery was sealed off. Gardaí set up a forensic tent and examined the body of Rachel O'Reilly.
They found a 5-page letter from O'Reilly in the coffin, and in it he wrote, "This is the hardest letter I've ever had to write for reasons only we know. Rachel, forgive me. 2 words, 1 sentence. I'll say them forever." And this was, again, another mistake he had made, and it was used, it was another block in the wall of circumstantial evidence against him.
Ultimately, the case goes to court. A jury finds him guilty. What's the sentence, and ultimately what happened with Joe O'Reilly?
Well, Joe O'Reilly got convicted of murder, and he got life imprisonment. And in his case, as he is part of a cohort of quite notorious killers in our prisons, life tends to mean life for these guys. Like, he's now in prison 18 years. The average life sentence is around 20. I would say he'll spend another 10 years in prison. He has never admitted or his guilt. He has never shown any kind of remorse. He has made several appeals, none of which have worked.
Joe O'Reilly has lost his attempt to have his murder conviction declared a miscarriage of justice. The Court of Appeal dismissed his application and said it was an unacceptable strategy to raise the arguments he had raised at this point. O'Reilly was found guilty of murdering his wife Rachel at their home in Nall, County Dublin, and sentenced to life in prison in July of 2007.
Joe O'Reilly is going to reside in prison until such time as a Minister for Justice decides, in consultation with the parole board, that he is a fit and proper person to be allowed out again. I think as long as Rachel Callaly's family have breath in them and they've been really strong on this and have campaigned and have honoured their daughter's memory, I don't think they'll allow that to happen. And I don't think any Minister for Justice is, like, as I say, again, there's a cohort of people like Joe O'Reilly who it'll take a very brave Justice Minister to decide and sign on the dotted line that these people should walk free and bloody right.
And my thanks to Paul Williams for joining me today. I'm Fiona Sheehan, and today's episode was produced and researched by Tabitha Monaghan, with sound design by Gavin Hennessy, clips from RTE and independent.ie. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow and leave us a review.